Some people would think your super data-driven team and culture, and it's all about analytics and measurement, does that mean you're less creative? I actually think it makes us more creative because we can take bigger risks because we know some things are not going to work, but we're going to measure it.
How do you create a culture in which everyone in your team is empowered to propose new experiments and gain insights from those experiments? Welcome to Data-Driven Decisions, the podcast that explores strategy, data, culture, and insights. I'm Zanti Ho, Managing Director of Convince and Convert, and author of the new book, Data-Driven Personalization. In today's conversation, my guest shares some fascinating examples of how his team has built a data-driven culture powered by curiosity and experimentation. This episode of Data-Driven Decisions is produced and edited by our friends at Content10x.com, who we highly recommend for all your digital content needs. What happens when a non-marketing data-driven leader is dropped into the role of a chief marketing officer? That's exactly what happened to my guest today, Shafkat Islam, who is the current chief marketing officer of Optimizely. But Shafkat, before you were at Optimizely, you were the founder and CEO of Welcome. So tell me a little bit about how you ended up in this role and what kind of perspectives you brought to the table as a data-driven leader into a marketing role.
Yeah, first of all, great to be here. And I often will tell people, you know, I've never been a marketer before and now I'm a CMO, and they think I'm joking, but it's actually a very serious statement. This is my first marketing role. In truth, I've been building products for marketers my whole life. So prior to this, you know, you mentioned Welcome. Welcome is marketing collaboration and content marketing platform where our customers were marketers of all sizes, mainly large enterprises. But, you know, prior to that, I was with the company which we rebranded to Welcome. It was called NewsCred, again, a content marketing company. So my whole life has been building products and servicing marketers. Now, as a CEO, I always had a marketing organization and marketing leader. And what happened post-acquisition is my new CEO, Alex Atzberger, he came to me and he said, "Hey, Shaf, I have this idea. You know, I'm trying to really transform how we do marketing." And people use the words marketing transformation all the time. And so I asked him, "Okay, what does that actually mean?" And he said, "Listen, we need to be more data-driven. We need to understand kind of the value of every dollar that we invest into marketing. We need to understand kind of the analytics behind our pipeline, behind our funnel, so that we can just make better decisions, but also understand like what's not working, what's working, and just be very honest about it and just treat everything in marketing like an experiment where there's going to be winners. There's, you know, I don't like saying losers. There's going to be learnings, and really change the culture of our marketing organization." So that was the biggest change that happened. And I said, "You know what, let's try it." I'm happy to share a little bit more about how that went. But that's really how I ended up as the CMO here about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I love it. Now, bringing your mindset to this existing marketing organization, what were the things that you implemented to build a more data-driven culture?
Yeah, so we have about 100-ish marketers, right, and spread out globally. So it was a pretty vast team, and both geographically vast, but also we have multiple products of this company, right? We have a CMS product. We have the CMP product that we acquired. We have a very large experimentation business. So it was a pretty complex marketing organization. But, you know, you hit the nail on the head in terms of like the biggest change was a cultural change. And, you know, one of the first things I set out was like, what are our marketing team values? And there's some obvious ones around like, we're going to measure everything. But one of the values that I put in place was no more marketing of marketing, which basically meant like, we're going to let the data do all the talking. If we're generating enough pipeline, if that's turning and converting into opportunities that close into sales, like people will know we're doing well. If there's events, field activities, campaigns that we're running where it doesn't work, we don't need to pretend like everything's a winner. Like, we're an experimentation company. We should be trying stuff all the time. So like, being comfortable with having things that don't work and learning from them, I think that was a big part of the cultural shift. And I think in general, it was the idea of be okay with the concept that a lot of marketing doesn't work. And this is a little bit of a controversial topic, but I did say in one of my first meetings with the whole team, like I said, hey, I won't be surprised if we stop doing all marketing today, like we'll still generate 60, 70% of our pipeline. Like we may not even notice that much. And to some people, that's a very shocking or almost insulting thing. But to me, it's a very freeing idea because it just means like, let's be unencumbered with all the decisions of the past. We shouldn't do something next year as part of our marketing strategy just because we did it last year. Just because everyone does webinars, everyone does content syndication, everyone does do we need to do all of these things? Let's do all the things that work. Let's try everything and let's like cut fast when it doesn't work.
I love that. And I love the way you describe your organization as an experimentation organization, right? Not only the product that you're providing, but even the culture itself. Tell me a little bit about how that impacts the creativity and decision-making of your marketing team.
Yeah. I mean, some people would think you're super data-driven team and culture, and it's all about analytics and measurement. Does that mean you're less creative? I actually think it makes us more creative because we can take bigger risks because we know like some things are not going to work, but we're going to measure it. And we're also, by the way, comfortable if there are certain things that we do that are not measurable, which sounds almost counterintuitive to everything else, but it's about intentionality. We want 80, 90% of the things we do to be measurable, and we will measure it. Some will win, some will not win, we'll learn. But it's also okay for 10 or 20% of our marketing to be a little bit crazy, a little bit high risk, even not measurable. As an example, we do a lot of out of home recently where we're trying some pretty bold, aggressive, creative, sometimes weird out of home campaigns. And the out of home vendors and my team, they'll tell us, yeah, we can measure out of home nowadays. We can measure billboard impact. Like we'll remarket through like mobile device targeting. My response is like, that feels like a stretch. Like it's fine. Like over time, brand will pay off. Like there's some brand investments that we'll make that may not be immediately measurable, and that's fine. But let's be intentional about that. And then let's measure the hell out of everything else. So I think just knowing which one is it and where are we in terms of like the risk taking. Our team, I think, is very creative and I give them a lot of permission to be creative. Also because, frankly, I find most B2B marketing super boring. So I just want to be interesting and memorable as a marketing organization.
I love that. And I think that your point about being freed by the data in some ways to take bigger risks and also to recognize what can be measured and what are the things that are unmeasurable but have overall impact also is a strategic decision-making process, right? It allows your team to think differently and to be critical about each decision that they actually make.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, even some of the crazy examples of out of home that I mentioned, we may do small tests of that creative on digital where we can measure, right? We'll take a wacky idea for a billboard and we'll just test it as a display ad on social and just see what kind of engagement we get from different cohorts. And it's a very small sample set, but at least we have some indication like, hey, this creative or this line, this tagline gets more attention, gets people to stop when they're scrolling through Instagram, right? So we can use data even to validate some of our creative bets that we have that are in channels that are typically not as measurable.
I love that. And I think that it's so smart to pair those more difficult to measure channels with those where you can do some controlled tests. And I mean, I think that testing is so much a part of the optimized laid product, service, culture itself. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you guys approach experimentation as an organization. You guys are not only providing the tools to allow people to conduct these experiments, but you're really helping your clients and customers to perform better, smarter experiments. Tell me a little bit about how you facilitate that and what you've learned along the way.
Yeah, experimentation is much more than tools. To me, it's the idea is how do we create a culture of experimentation? That's the first and foremost thing that I focus on. You know, there's this great Jeff Bezos quote from his, I think the early days of Amazon, where he says, Like the success of Amazon is predicated on the number of experiments or tests that they run daily, weekly, monthly, right? That's how important he thinks the testing culture is at Amazon. And similarly, I want to do something here where we're creating a culture of testing. Testing is not just limited to the two or three people on the digital team who may be the product owner of the experimentation platform. Obviously, it's our own platform, but it's how do we turn everyone in marketing or everyone in the company into kind of testers, right? Like anyone can come up with a great test idea or a hypothesis. So part of creating the culture is teaching people how to come up with test ideas, how to generate like good hypotheses, feeling safe about suggesting test ideas. And so all of that is part of the culture. Another part of the culture is sharing results openly and transparently. So we will, whether they're winners or learnings, share those. We try and provide visibility so everyone can see what else are we testing right now on our site or on email or different channels. So like, it's just part of the fabric of our marketing organization. And it, again, it has nothing to do with the tools. We have a lot of tools that help. You know, we have an experimentation collaboration product, which is not related to the testing itself, but like the culture of testing. So a tool where we can solicit test ideas, prioritize ideas, provide an experimentation calendar, provide visibility to the whole organization around the program. Something like that helps create the culture.
I love that.
And then in terms of like the hardcore testing itself, obviously we have experts who are good at that. That's a skill set that they've learned and trained themselves over some period of time. And they help others or they'll take the lead when it comes to running the experiments. But anyone in the company can be part of the program by, you know, anyone can have a great idea and we should test it.
I love that. And I love the way you talk about creating a culture where everybody can come to the table with the hypotheses in hand and that everyone's free to share in the results of that testing as well, because that's something that I talk about in my book, that there's a certain amount of psychological safety that you need to create within your organization, but also a desire to be curious, right? If people have questions that they want answered, part of the experimentation and quite frankly, part of, I think, the responsibility of the marketing organization is to make sure that we've actually got answers that help inform our teams so that we can then create more relevant products, services, experiences, support, et cetera, for our organization. So I love that that's something that you guys are actually championing within the work that you're doing on your team. That's very powerful.
We almost make fun of it a little bit here. You know, we have this concept of the HIPPO, which is the highest paid person's opinion. And we often will challenge the HIPPOs. And the HIPPOs are the people who come in and say, oh, I think the homepage needs to be blue, not pink. Or I think we should change the call to action. Or I think this type of content doesn't work. And we have created the safety where we can always challenge the HIPPO within our company and say, you know what? You may be right, you may be wrong, but we're going to test it, right? And so I think part of that is we've injected some humor into it.
I love that story. That's great. I wanted to shift gears and talk a little bit about personalization. Now, I know that you guys actually have a new personalization offering. I'd love for you to give us a little bit of an overview about that. But you also talked about the fact that one of the reasons that you came out with this personalization was because you were hearing a need from your customers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let's start with the second part of your question. So we do a lot of events. Opticon is our flagship event. We always measure like which breakouts get the most attendees. We capture a lot of feedback. We also anecdotally, we are doing events all the time. And one thing that we've noticed is the number one topic that people are interested in, especially on the marketing organization side, is personalization. Now, the funny thing is this has been the number one topic for like 20 years and you're still writing books about it, right? It just shows A, the pain is real. Like people really want to solve this problem. They think the upside is real because we think it's a better customer experience, but it's hard. It's hard to solve. And so we'll talk about why it's hard in a second. On our side, on the Optimizely side, so we're known for experimentation. Within our experimentation product, we always had personalization capabilities because we think the two actually go really hand in hand, right? You might think you should personalize your site for, based on industry. You then have to test, did that personalization by industry actually yield more MQLs or more conversions, right? So the testing and the personalization go hand in hand, because just because you have ideas for how you should personalize doesn't mean that it works. In fact, most of the time it doesn't work is what our research shows. So we've always had the capability, but because we've heard from our customers that this is such a pain, that it's still hard to solve, sometimes it's not as easy to get started, we really put a lot of focus and investment and R&D effort into personalization as a standalone capability. So we are going to launch it as a standalone product with a lot more capability and innovation and kind of investment into the roadmap. So I'm just teasing a little bit of it here. Like, you'll find out more in the next couple months. It'll be made much more public. But ultimately, the goal is to help marketers solve this kind of never-ending problem, which is, how do I personalize my website or web experience or mobile app or email, whatever it is? How do I do that? How do I do it at the right level, which is, you know, what hierarchy of personalization? Is it kind of based on the highest level and maybe where someone's visiting from, or down to the individual? And then how do I test if it's actually working?
That's great. And one of the things that you and I talked about when I interviewed you for my book was that, let's call it, realistic approach to personalization, right? How far down do we need to get? Do we need this to be a one-on-one experience? Is that even worth it from an organizational perspective? How do you analyze that in the data, and how do you make sure that you are balancing practicality with a personalized, relevant experience?
Yeah, this is the number one challenge that I think a lot of our customers face, which is, how do I even get started? Because the problem seems so vast. And usually the vastness of the problem is tied to the volume of content required in order to do that personalization. And the volume of content is dependent on what level or granularity of personalization do you want to do, right? And so if you take the easiest, someone comes to my website, and let's just pretend it's a website for now. I personalize based on geography or IP address, right? That's pretty easy. You can change some copy around, et cetera. The next level of personalization may be, you know what, I'm going to try and figure out what industry this person is. I might use Sixth Sense, or I might use some other data provider to figure out, like, some sort of way to enrich the data to say, I think you're in financial services. I can also figure that out based on context clues, based on what content you're reading. So there's a number of ways I can make the determination you're in a certain industry. Now, all of a sudden, I want to do industry-based personalization. And that means industry case studies, industry language used on the product page, industry focus, like use cases. So now the content burden is getting higher and higher. Think about that, doing it down to an individual company level. Oh, you're from Coca-Cola. This is what we do for Coca-Cola or for beverages. And this is like something maybe we've created just for you as a company, as the CMO of the company, down to the individual. And you can start to get a sense, like, the content requirement starts becoming massive. And so I always tell our customers, and I also tell our team, let's just start simple, right? So before we get to one-on-one personalization or individualization, are we at least nailing the industry-based personalization? Do we even have that level of content? Obviously, AI can help now to help create variations of content. So if we have really good research, could we create like a little addendum or a variation that's more industry-focused? We're exploring all of that. So I think just keeping it real around, like, how much content can you realistically produce as an organization? And then using that to determine what level of personalization you want to do. That's number one. And the second is, what access to data do you have?
Yeah, I think that you bring up an excellent point, which is, don't bite off more than you can chew, and to take a crawl, walk, run approach, right? Where we are being thoughtful about how much our organization is mature enough to handle. When you are thinking about advising your clients on using your tools and taking this thoughtful content marketing approach, how do you help them to be thoughtful about their own data that's available and to make these kinds of decisions?
Yeah, data is usually, I was going to say, the biggest blocker. It could be content, it could be data. I'll give you an example. Let's make it tangible, right? So I want to personalize based on if you're a prospect or a customer. That's the first step. I'm just saying, as CMO of Optimizely. In if you're a customer, I want to know what products are you using. We're a multi-product company, right? So if you're using, I don't know, let's say you're using our CMS product, then I want to give you content that's about the upstream planning of content, right? Like ideation, planning, collaboration of content. Because I know you're using us to publish it, but what about all this stuff upstream before the CMS? So I have all these great ideas. It seems supernatural. Figure out if they're a customer, figure out if they're using CMS, and then give them great content about upstream planning. And then if they're interested, they'll buy our CMP, right? It never works that way, but let's just pretend that's the magical funnel that I'm going to send someone through. In that case, I need to determine, is there a way for me to reasonably identify with a high enough match rate if someone is a customer or not? Where's that data living? Salesforce. So do I have a connector with Salesforce? In our case, we do. Our Salesforce is connected to our data platform. We have something called ODP, Optimizely Data Platform. It's essentially a CDP. And then I have the ability on my website to personalize based on segments, which could be customer versus prospect to segments. So I can do all of that reasonably well because I have a Salesforce connector. But then the next question is, do I then know what products they're using? Now I have to ask myself, do I have that data? And okay, I might have that data in Salesforce. Is that data being passed through the connector to all of these channels? And can I create a segment for customer who uses CMS as an example? I'm getting like very practical here, but these are the types of questions I think people need to start asking before they just jump on the personalization bandwagon.
Well, and I think that you touch upon something that's really important, which is not only what is the integration across your different tools within your ecosystem, but also what are the different touch points that your customer actually experiences along their customer journey, right? Oftentimes, I think as marketers, we take for granted that we're going to be able to track this information, but because that data lives in disparate places, it's not necessarily a unified experience for our customers. And oftentimes we get it wrong when we're actually putting content in front of them. How do you overcome that from a technological standpoint?
Well, I think before we solve the technology problem here, that customer journey, this might sound super basic, but has anyone in the organization actually mapped that out and drawn it on a piece of paper or a whiteboard? And is it institutionalized and documented so everyone can see? Because just think about that journey. That impacts my social team, my email marketing team, my web team, my product team, because they're part of the journey is like in our products, right? They're like logging into our product. And so I think documenting that entire customer journey and those touch points, it sounds like something that, you know, a company does once every few years. They get a bunch of post-it notes and maybe they pay an agency, but like, it's not just fun and games. I think it's really, really important to document that and understand all the touch points and then come up collectively as a marketing organization. Like, what do we want that ideal journey to be? What kind of content? What feeling do we want the customer to have as they go through this? Even basic things like, how do we communicate? How do we talk to customers? What's the language we use? When during their customer journey, not just the journey of like how they're interacting with our digital touch points, but also their journey in our company's funnel, like prospect just became a customer and now renewing, right? So that's another life stage of the customer plus the journey. Now all of a sudden you're getting pretty complex, and it's only once you map all of that out can you decide what is the ideal journey that we want someone to go through. It's obviously not linear. It's like crazy. There's people coming in and out at all stages, but I would say that's the biggest blocker much more than any sort of technology.
Yeah, I love that you actually come back to the fundamentals of the customer journey map. And even really understanding what are those touch points. Because I think, again, from a digital perspective and a data collection perspective, if we don't have clarity about the customer journey and what we need to not only measure, but be able to personalize and deliver against, then we don't actually have clarity of how all of these pieces fit together.
It's not just marketing. There's a lot of different teams that are involved in the customer journey too, right? I have my customer success team maybe sending tips and tricks on how to adopt our products, right? Product sending messages around new releases. We have my product marketing team sending like webinars around releases and roadmap. Like there's a lot of people that are bombarding the customer with messages. So being really good about orchestrating all of that and like keeping the customer at the center and making sure like, hey, from their perspective, what does this journey look like? I think is really important. That's on the customer side. Obviously on the prospect side, there's not as many people reaching out, so it's a little bit easier.
Sure, but I think that that's also really important because oftentimes I think that as marketers, we feel like a lot of our role is related to the prospect. But the truth is that the customer should be a major part of the way that we think about our marketing strategy, right? And in fact, in the book, I really explore a lot of topics around how do you nurture the customer so that they feel really integrated into the community and the ecosystem that you've created. How do you guys at Optimizely address that and make sure that your customers are getting the right resources? So again, as they're thinking about, you know, not only their planning process, but you know, the next stage down, they're really thinking of you as part of their go-to toolbox.
Yeah. First of all, if I could like plus 1,000 your comment, I would. It's so critical. We actually had an interesting milestone announcement yesterday. I'm gonna talk about that for a second. I'll explain why. So, and we chatted about it right before the podcast. So we announced we're at 400 million of ARR. Now that's a big number. The crazy thing is, every single year we renew about 3/4 of that, let's call it, or maybe even bigger, right? So most of our base of business is actually renewing existing customers. The new customer amount is actually a small percentage of that total number, right? And so we add new customers every year, but the volume of existing customers that we're renewing is massive. And the company's success and equity value and all of that is really, can we retain customers and can we grow existing customers into multi-product customers? So as a marketing leader, if I'm not focused on that customer base, then I'm missing something really, really critical. And you're right. A lot of marketers think like, oh, our job is to get prospects down the funnel and convert them into sales. For me, my job, half of my job is market to the existing customer base. Part of it is, yes, I want them to have a great experience and interact with our brand and feel good, blah, blah, blah. But really part of it is, how do I turn customers into multi-product customers? How do I nurture them so at renewal they upsell or cross-sell? How do I tell them about product announcements and give them the right product marketing so they're interested and know that we can solve their pain points? So to me, marketing is as much about the customer as it is about the prospect. In fact, in a business of our scale, it may be more customer than even prospect.
That's great to hear. And I think that your examples are so powerful because I do think that mindset about who are we nurturing and how do we continue to make sure that our customers do renew and do continue with us forward, that is really important. I'd love to use that as a pivot point to talk a little bit about how you guys approach researching and understanding your existing customers. What are the things that you actually do to make sure that you are meeting their needs, but also discovering those opportunities, as you were talking about with personalization, for instance, of the next thing down your product pipeline that helps to address their issues? How do you go out and learn about your customers?
Yeah, I think we can do better on this topic. There's almost no amount of time that's too much time with your customers. So obviously, our product teams are very customer focused and they talk to product all the time. From a marketing side, you know, we do a lot of like customer advisory boards. We do a lot of events with our customers. So, you know, when our field marketing team, before I took over, it was 90%. They were focused 90% new logo, 10% base. We've like shifted that. We haven't flipped it, but we've shifted that materially. So we do a lot of customer events where we just ask them. Like sometimes we forget the most basic marketing tactic in our toolkit is just ask the person. So we get them into roundtables. We often will let them share amongst each other their biggest challenges, pain points, how they're solving it. And we listen to all those conversations. We obviously survey our customers. We reach out to them and we do a lot of webinars with our customers around product roadmaps, et cetera, where we get their feedback. We look at what questions they're asking. I think we could do a better job. You know, I haven't figured out how do we do it at a scale that's more kind of automated or semi-automated. It still feels quite like in person or on calls or on QBRs or events, but always up. I don't know if you have ideas, but yeah, we need to get better.
Well, you know, I'll just speak to that last question that you mentioned, which is around, you know, how do you scale it or how do you make it easier to automate? And you know, we've been working with a partner in the last couple of years called Converge that is essentially a platform for digital virtual focus groups. And it allows us to connect with, you know, up to 200 people at a time in real time, asking them questions, getting the feedback, being able to share that, and actually for them to be able to see the feedback from other people in real time. But it allows a lot more people to participate. And that's something that we've found really valuable working with many of our clients, to get that kind of feedback from real individuals, but at scale, in a way that is still a shared experience. Because I think in the virtual space, what you don't want to lean too heavily into is just expecting people to fill out forms, right? Ultimately, the voice of the customer and allowing people to have feedback in real time and react to the things that are being discussed actually can be really informative within your community. So I think finding a way that allows us to make that more effective is one of the things that we have done and really found effective with our customers.
And I like that. You know, our product team does some things that are a little bit more at scale, like there's forums where people can like submit product ideas and vote them up and down and leave comments and things like that. I would love to do this a little bit more, you know, to your point on the marketing side, to understand their pain, their needs, their wants. How can we better market to them?
Well, the example that you share about the product team reminds me of an example that I have in the book, which is that Starbucks for many years actually had this community that was essentially allowing you to upvote or downvote not only products, but services or features that you wanted in stores. And some of their best ideas actually came out of this community. You know, those little hole plugging sticks that you see in the Starbucks cups to keep your cups from spilling when you carry them around, that came out of the community. Some of their different weird drinks like dragon fruit drink and whatnot came from the community. And so I think that when you allow your customers who are passionate about the product and thoughtful about how they actually experience it day to day to share those points of view in a meaningful and productive way, and that they're taken seriously and that they see that they're taken seriously, I think that that becomes part of the value add and another opportunity to collect feedback in a meaningful way.
I love those examples. I think that is something that we, as a company, you know, we think about software companies all the time because we're in this space, but, you know, if Starbucks can do it at scale and actually turn these wacky ideas into real product ideas, like, we absolutely should be doing it.
Yeah, but I love that you're asking the question, because I think that that's where we get the good ideas, to be getting not only good customer feedback, but to be driven by the feedback that we're actually getting from our customers. And ultimately, I think that that's what this podcast is all about, really understanding how do we collect more information that allows us to be more valuable to our customers, to make better decisions from not only a marketing standpoint, but an experience standpoint.
Yeah. And one thing we are doing here, which early days that we're experimenting with, is AI. So we can use AI to summarize kind of all the insights and like what are the topics, pain points that are coming up in thousands or tens of thousands of support interactions, questions that we get, calls that we're on. So we're trying to see, can we synthesize those things? Like, we're starting with just support, right? People ask us questions all the time. Hey, I'm trying to do XYZ in your product. And so being able to take those tens of thousands of support tickets, but also just questions that, you know, our CSMs are fielding, using AI to summarize those and like group them into topics or at least problem areas. That's something that we are experimenting with right now.
I love that. And I think that's a super actionable approach that many of our listeners can engage with in their own organizations, because I think you're exactly right. I mean, I used to work for a company at the beginning of my career where, you know, we had tens of thousands of interactions with customers and customer service data. Of course, you code it by hand and then you're kind of reviewing it from time to time. But with the power of AI, you really are able to get not only those themes out, but even to identify some trends over time, right? What are the things that are suddenly rising, and what are the things that suddenly people have a lot of questions about?
Yeah, another experiment we're trying is sales calls. Like, now this is prospects. We record a lot of our sales calls, right? So a lot of companies use Zoom or Gong, et cetera, to record. Those all have AI capabilities now as well. And so being able to synthesize hundreds or thousands of those prospect calls, just to see like, hey, what are some of the challenges that customers are talking about or prospects are talking about? So that's another thing that we are doing. We were listening to these calls manually, but obviously that has limits. And so now we're trying to see if we could scale that as another input.
I love that. Again, I think that that's so fascinating. And it really gives you some really usable voice of customer data that then your team can really take action against. So I think those are fantastic examples. Shafqa, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Again, for folks who are listening, please do make sure to pick up a copy of the book because there are some great interviews and great quotes from Shafqa in the book as well. Again, you have been such a fun guest to have on the show, and I hope that folks will stay tuned into your LinkedIn, particularly to hear more about the personalization announcements from Optimizely, because there's some really exciting stuff coming down the pike.
Awesome. I love it. I love chatting, and these are topics that are near and dear to my heart. I think we're all in the journey together to figure it out. So stay tuned for more from Optimizely.
Find more episodes of Data Driven Decisions in your favorite podcast player, in its own feed, or in the Social Pros podcast feed. Interested in learning more about the concepts we discussed in today's episode? Be sure to pick up a copy of my book at koganpage.com/data-driven-personalization, or subscribe for more content from Convince and Convert at convinceandconvert.com.